you Romeo India Whiskey. This is my call letters. My name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2 Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick try to act as the net coordinators, the net control for this technical net. The technical net meets every Sunday evening from 8 o'clock until whenever. Used to be until only 1 hour. Lately it's going on for 3, 4, and even more hours. You guys have heard it a million times, but for the new people who are finding the TechNet for the first time or finding it on the Internet, I give a little bit of a couple-minute explanation in the beginning as to what it is and what we intend to do. The main purpose is education. Lots of brain power in the New York City, New York, Long Island, Connecticut, and New Jersey area. And we try to tap into that. And these amateurs are the ones with a little bit more scientific bent that usually meet here. Although not necessarily. No question is too dumb to be asked, so don't worry about that. We try to cater to both beginners and people who have been around for a long time. The usual schedule is the following. For those who sign in the beginning for the first hour, we try to handle everybody so that nobody has to wait for more than an hour to get at least a preliminary answer to their ham radio related questions. The first hour is almost purely ham radio related questions. At the end of that hour, Mel opens his mailbag. He sometimes gets as many as 300 emails and other kinds of communication per week, usually from the beginning amateurs, the guys who don't have a license yet. On their scanner, they found us, or by word of mouth, they found us and said, gee, these guys are having fun. I want to join that. So these guys are in the process of getting their ham radio license, and they've got questions. As you remember what it was like when you were studying for your license, it seemed like there was a lot more that you needed to know than easy to find out, if you know what I mean. Beyond the mailbag, Paul, WS2N, is our space expert. He tells us what NASA is doing, and the very last shuttle launch is about to take place. And I think there's also the possibility of viewing the shuttle by way of, you know, the way it flashes at you at dusk. I think that some of those orbits are going to be taking place in the next few days. And after that, we dig into the deeper stuff. Somewhere around 9:30 or so, we start the conversation for those who are more scientific bent. In other words, the guys who want to know down at the molecular level what's really happening with radio propagation and signal flow and fields and waves and so on. And that subject doesn't please everyone, but you know ahead of time that it's coming, and you've got 800 channels on your 2-meter radio if it's synthesized, and therefore you can, if that displeases, you can tune to one of the other channels. Occasionally you'll hear some disruption. There are people who don't like the fact that these guys are enjoying themselves as they dig into the physics of what's really going on, and they sometimes try to stop that action, and they're probably wasting their time, and we should
repeater timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Instead of getting angry at those people, we should just feel sorry for them. But they're trying to stop someone else from having pleasure, and obviously they wouldn't feel motivated to do that if they were getting enough pleasure in their particular life. So we should feel sorry for them as opposed to angry. We don't respond to them because you're only giving them recognition if you do that. Okay, a person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So give me your call letters and name at this time.
S.
Okay, who was that again? I heard the word S at the end.
KC2ZQJ, Dave, yes.
Okay, Kilo Charlie 2, Zebra, Quebec, Juliet, Dave. Do I have you correct, Dave?
Yes, Dick, thank you.
Okay, so far we got Dave. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time. There is a person who apparently has no audio, giving us a dead carrier. So we heard that one before, and we heard it after Dave. So that person may have to check his microphone. So who else is to sign in besides Dave? We've got Dave so far. Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
NBC. No question.
And that mysterious voice was Bob, K4NBC. Out of curiosity, Bob, are you coming in directly right now on 10 meters tonight? Go ahead.
No, negative, Dick. I'm coming in on Echolink.
Hey, Bob, you're cheating. Bob quite often comes in directly on 10 meters. He's got a very significant antenna down there in Florida. Okay, with apparently no questions yet, but maybe you'll have some later, Bob, or some comments as to what it's like in Florida. We got Dave's phone. Anyone else to check into the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2MDP.
KC2MDP. Okay. I'm assuming you've got a real question or a comment. Is that true?
Yeah, that is correct. I'm the one with no audio. I forgot to flip a switch here. Sorry about that.
Okay. Now we really got you. Steve, isn't it? Boy, am I terrible on names. Your handle is Steve, is that true?
Yes, I'm terrible on giving names. Sorry again, Dick.
Alrighty. You did check in first, even though you had no audio, so I'm gonna put you first, Steve. One last call. Anyone else to give me call letters and name to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now.
This is N2MB, N2 Mike Bravo in Rockaway Beach, and I got no questions or anything else, but I'm here. Bye.
Well, glad to hear from Rockaway Beach, or Far Rockaway. And that mysterious person was Barry, N2 Moonbounce, or N2 Meatball, I think he sometimes has used. Okay, let's start off with Steve's first question, KC2MDP. What would you like to know about tonight, Steve?
Okay, Dick, speaking of dumb questions, this seems like a dumb question to me, but I'll throw it out to you because I'm really not sure of the answer. Antenna tuner, an HF antenna tuner, is it possible to use this on VHF? Back to you.
I'd say the answer is yes. I'm going to, since one of the guys who's normally around here is Mel, and he builds antenna tuners, he probably has a little more direct answer to that. The only thing I'd worry about is that the antenna tuner, let me backtrack now. If it's an automatic antenna tuner, I worry a little bit. If it was a manually operated antenna tuner, or if you have a manual mode, I think you can do it. What I worry about a little bit is that you know when you've got the right tuning with the antenna tuner by way of its built-in standing wave ratio detector. The standing wave ratio detector is connected to the front end, in other words, the exciter side, the transmitter side, not the antenna side, and it's looking for forward power and reflected power due to standing wave ratio. And so you operate those controls until the reflected power from the tuner back to the transmitter is minimized, and that way you've hit correct tuning. Most standing wave ratio detectors are somewhat frequency sensitive. In other words, from the given frequency they're designed for down to lower frequencies, they work very well. If you go far above the frequency where they're designed, sometimes they can give you some crazy results. The diodes, if they weren't super fast diodes, might not rectify as well. The coupler itself might have a little bit less than normal directivity. It's got to have good directivity to sense the difference between forward power and reverse power. So as long as you're willing to accept the fact that it might tune in a little bit of a funny way, as long as you're willing to double check it by way of, say, for instance, a bird wattmeter, if you had a bird wattmeter or some other kind of directional detecting device in between the transmitter and the tuner, and you tune the tuner for a minute.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you tune the tuner for minimum reflected power, you've arrived. There's a slim chance also that the particular components that were selected for the tuner might become a little bit lossier at the higher frequencies. I kind of doubt it. So usually nothing bad's going to happen. It's not going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire. I don't think you can do damage to it. Yes, if you were if you were taking an antenna tuner that was rated for a kilowatt and you're putting 1,500 watts into it at twice the frequency where it's rated, you'd be pushing your luck. You're not doing that. I'm guessing you've got a 100-watt rig going into a kilowatt-capable tuner. And as I said, the automatic mode might give you some grief if you've got a manual mode, and I think you can do it. And if you've got a secondary way of checking when you've got good tuning, I think it's a good way of doing it. Let's see if Mel's available. I wonder if you've ever seen people, known of people like yourself, going beyond the design frequency for an antenna tuner. If Mel's there, it's going to pick up. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2MIT checking.
N2XJN comment.
MIT and XJN both recognized. Mel first, K2KEY, if you're there. And maybe Mel's not there tonight. K2MIT, go right ahead with your question. What's your comment on this particular subject?
I'm here, Dick. Got tied up.
Okay. So the question, Mel, I'll repeat it just in case you didn't hear it all, and that is Steve is asking if he takes a 80 to 10 meter antenna tuner, for instance, and uses it on a higher frequency like 6 meters. I think he's not going to get into trouble, but you may have some opinions on that. Go right ahead, Mel.
Well, the tuners that they make today, you know, with the rotary, and most of them all, I don't know which tuner, but, you know, run-of-the-mill tuner seems to be based on that Pi-T type, or whatever they call it, you know, and then each one has another name for it, but basically, you know, it's a capacitor, rotary inductor to ground, back to another capacitor, and they'll say that it's good from, you know, across the HF bands, but I'll tell you something, it depends on what you're connecting to, you know, kind of antennas and all, and many times they're very flexible, you know, in what you can do with them, Dick. You'll be amazed. I wouldn't doubt that you'd most likely easily get that rotary inductor because it goes down literally to nothing and goes across the entire coil. So no doubt I would bet possibly you find somewhere a match even on 6 meters with it over.
Yeah, you're supporting what I think is happening. Once you understand what an antenna tuner does, whether it be a Pi network, an L network, or a Pi L, or whatever, it first resonates and then presents the right impedance match. If your antenna is really far out, like a 15-to-1 standing wave ratio, you might easily run out of range, although my experience with things like antenna tuners tells me that as you go higher and higher in frequency, there's less and less chance that you're going to run out of range. When you run out of range, it's because you've gone to such a low frequency that you can't bring the capacitive reactants down to a low enough number. You don't have a big enough variable capacitor to go low enough in frequency. Going up high, I think it's going to work. And as I said, with rare exception, I don't think it's going to create any damage. Let's see what Jeff's got to say about this. I wonder if you've run into a situation like this, Jeff. K2MIT, boy, do I like those call letters. Massachusetts Institute of Technology, K2RIW. You got it, Jeff.
Yeah, you won't do any damage. What happens is you just won't get a match. It's been my my experience. I've worked with the LDG tuners and the some of the MFJ tuners. They keep on clicking and clicking and clicking and clicking till they stop. They're pretty well buffered and they're pretty well secured on both sides, so they don't damage the rig. And they throw the rig usually into 5 watts output or 10 watts or something like that. So it's not much to destroy in those things to begin with. That's my comment. And then when it comes around for questions, I have a question.
Okay, you're on the list for a question, Jeff, but let me find out some specifics. Your setup goes to 5 watts for the tune mode. I'm going to guess that it was something like an 80 through 10 meter antenna tuner, and I'm going to guess that you were trying to operate on either 6 meters or 2 meters. You're going above its frequency range, and you were using it in the automatic tuning mode. Please give me some confirmation on that. And does your unit have a manual operating mode? Like the possibility exists that you would manually find a solution that it wasn't able to find automatically. That's a guess on my part. So did you have a manual mode? And what was the combination of frequencies of what you were trying versus what it was rated for? Back to you, Jeff, K2RIW.
It's impossible the way the AT-11 Pro, I think that's what it was called, for you to manually dial in something that it could not automatically dial in. It was really for touching it up, so to say. There was no combination of inductance and capacitance that you could dial in that wasn't a combination of automatic. So if you tried to tune on 6 meters, you just couldn't, no matter what you tried to do, automatic mode, which it had, or manual mode, which it had. Over.
Okay, so in the manual mode, no matter how you twisted the knobs, are you saying that if you were looking at only its own front panel instrumentation, where it's measuring standing wave ratio, you never got a dip, is what I think you're saying? Or if you were using an auxiliary detecting device like a bird wattmeter between the transmitter and the tuner, you were never able to get a dip no matter how you manually operated those knobs. Is that sort of what you're saying, Jeff? Back to you, Jeff, K2RIW, and do wait for the beep.
Okay, thanks for the reminder on the beep, K2MIT. Yes, I never got an acceptable SWR, and I did have an external... I have the LP100A digital vector RF wattmeter. I forget the guy who builds them. A nice fellow. Forget the name of the company, but very accurate. And I think the closest I got was like 3.5 to 1. And at that, you might as well just screw in a light bulb and transmit into a light bulb. It's just not worth it. Over.
Now, I'm going to double-check on something here, Jeff. If you were using your external directional wattmeter in between the transmitter and the tuner, and you couldn't get it below 3 to 1, did any of the knobs that you were manually turning run out of range? Did you go, all the way to the left or all the way to the right? I mean, if a knob was giving you the best dip in the middle of that knob, and then you go to the other knob and you get the best possible dip, I'm trying to find out, first of all, was the directional wattmeter in the right place? It's very logical for a person to put the directional wattmeter between the tuner and the antenna, because you're trying to correct the biswar of the antenna. Very logical to put it there. And you might not get a solution there. You can't. You can't get a solution there. So you're fairly sure you put it in the right place. And was there a knob that ran out of range far to the left or far to the right? Back to you, Jeff, K2RIW.
Now, I have my wattmeter exactly where you described, between the antenna and the tuner. And mine didn't have dials. It had up and down switches, so you'd have to literally switch down, 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 up, 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 which was quite the procedure, mind you, to go through the range of... of capacitance and inductance, so it was quite an affair. But no, I could never personally get it, and maybe that's a function of my antenna, which at the time was a pretty short dipole. It did 10 through 80 pretty well, actually very well. Worked Norway on 80, but was trying to get it to work on 6 and just could not. Then put up a 6 meter antenna and could, of course, get a perfect match on it. But when trying to work with an antenna that was not meant for that band and an antenna tuner, just there was no combination. If that is the question you're asking, which I believe it is, I was never able to do it.
Okay, you said something a little bit confusing that time, Jeff. You said you're sure you had the directional wattmeter in the right place between the antenna and the tuner. And that's the logical place to put it. And I'm pretty sure that that's the wrong place. Maybe you just misspoke, but you said those words. I put it in the right place. I put it between the antenna and the tuner. It's got to be going between the tuner and the transmitter. Is that where you had your directional watt meter? Over to you, Jeff.
Well, let me clear that up. I have two watt meters. One between the radio and the tuner, and one between the tuner and the antenna.
Okay, that's an ideal setup. Now, the one between the tuner and the antenna, you're just tuning it for maximum forward power, in other words, the greatest deflection. And the one between the transmitter and the tuner, you're looking at reverse power, and you're tuning it for minimum reverse power. So I think you're saying as you were pressing the up, 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 and down, down, down commands, you got it to 3-1. But when you try to go beyond on either of those controls, I think you're saying that no matter how you rock the controls from that point, either the control ran out of range or you couldn't get it to below 3-1. Give me a confirmation on that one, Jeff, on those couple of comments. You got it, Jeff. K2LIW.
K2MIT, I could not get it below 3-1. I could not get it into a mode where I could operate the radio comfortably. I would be wasting electrons, as they say.
I know it's going to seem like I'm dwelling much too long on this one. So you got it down to 3-1. Let's assume now you have two separate controls, a tuning and a loading control, so to speak. And as you go up, 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 down, 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 and you're doing the equivalent of rocking the tuning control, you saw it dip as low as 3-1. And as you went lower or higher, it started coming back up. Then when you go into the other control, again, as you went lower or higher, it came back up from 3-1. That, in other words, if there were two controls, no matter how you operated those two controls, the dip got no better than 3-1, either because the steps were too big when you hit an up, 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 or a down, down, down. In other words, you skipped over the sweet spot, so to speak. Or you got to a spot when you hit up, up, or down, down, it no longer moved. It was already at limit. What is your memory as to how that was working, Jeff? Go ahead.
My memory was it was already at its limit. It was a 10-1. Most tuners can deal with, I think, 3-1. Most tuners in radio can deal with a 3-1 mismatch. And most LDG tuners and some other brand tuners can deal with 10-1. This was greater than 10-1 and could not bring it down to an acceptable visuar. And no matter what I did, with each of the buttons, up, 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 down, 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 up, 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 down, 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 I could not get it to an operating position that I felt comfortable with. I think I've answered your question, which I don't think you dwelled upon, but I think I've answered your question. Please let me know.
You've definitely answered the question, Jeff. Was it a 6-meter antenna, and for a 10-1 standing wave ratio, it sounds like there was an error in the antenna itself, like something was disconnected. Is that approximately what was happening, Jeff?
KY, another comment.
We'll go with the comment, but yes, I believe there was an error. That's why I ended up getting a dedicated 6-meter antenna.
Oh, so it was an antenna not intended for 6 meters, is what I think you're saying. Mel, go ahead with your comment.
Yes, it's the old cliche, you pay what you get what you pay for, or what's available. The homebrew tuner, I have a few tuners. I have, Johnson Kilowatt Matchbox tuner, great tuner and all. Then I have a homebrew, very sophisticated tuner that was known as the Easy Tuner that was featured in 2 months' articles by QST some years ago. that has both electric tuning and also manual tuning. In other words, it's basically a manual tuner with motors on it that you can put into this memory device that, for remembering, you know, once it's preset to certain, once you get to a band, you preset everything up, you can, you know, go right to it by pushing a button or presetting it automatically. You know, in other words, it's got all that flexibility. And, you know, just look up, for instance, the rotary inductor that went into it, here, 15 micro rotary inductor that went into it, no longer available. It was specially made by P.I. Dux Corporation. The price on it is more, that rotary inductor was more than would cost you for an entire tuner today, whatever's on the market. The variable capacitors, these butterfly, what we call butterfly, differential capacitors, which is their real name, we call them, reference butterfly capacitors, 500 PF each, and 10 KV breakdown, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's your story, Dick.
Wow. That is a Cadillac tuner that you described to me there. What a piece of hardware. My guess is a little bit on the massive side. Because of its physical size, because of the cost of its components, I think it's very unlikely that we could buy a thing like that, that somebody would mass produce it. They'd be afraid they wouldn't have big enough sales to go through all the process of the research and development for productizing such a thing. So if I really need a good antenna tuner, I know where to go. I'm going to go to your particular street, Mel. Wesley, I know that you had some further questions or comments about antenna tuners, and I believe that you and John have also been collecting some of these variable rotary induct tuners that maybe you're collecting for this exact kind of a purpose. N2XJN, K2RIW in the SICnet.
Yeah, N2XJN. Yes, we're trying to acquire two huge coils, about 17 inches across and about 90 inches tall if you put them vertically. But in regards to the antenna tuners, for the frequency range from 144 to 220 megahertz, MFJ has made a MFJ 921, and I have it. I use it for many years, and I bought it probably in the 90s, put it somewhere to some boxes, and I found it and I installed it. It works great. So somebody wants to have a very inexpensive one, I would say this is one of the best solutions. But Tudyk, and Tudyk.
KC2ZQJ comment.
Dave recognized. That's unusual, Wes. That is, most people will use an antenna tuner from 80 through 10 meters. Very occasionally on 6 meters. An antenna tuner that works from 144 to 220, in my experience, is a rare item. I think the number of hams in the United States who own such a thing is fairly small. And there's a couple of reasons for that. The VHF rigs seem to be a little bit more forgiving. The HF rigs, for a whole bunch of reasons, when you go beyond 1.5 or 1.8 standing wave ratio, the so-called no-tune rigs get into a fair amount of trouble. The way the rigs are designed for the VHF, UHF frequencies, they usually have a final stage that can tolerate for some period of time a direct short circuit or an open circuit without burning up. As such, they feel that there's not quite as much of a need. The average amateur thinks he's tuning for a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio in order to get maximum forward power. In reality, he's tuning for maximum reverse power because that particular 80 through 10 meter final stage can't tolerate very much without going into one of its failure modes. But as you start plotting forward power versus standing wave ratio, you realize it's got to be pretty fierce. A 5.6 or a 5.8 standing wave ratio, as bad as that sounds, that's only half the power of being reflected. Not lost necessarily, but reflected. And so you still have at least 50% of your power output. And if you're using a 50-watt mobile rig and 25 watts is still getting to the antenna, which is only 3 dB down, half an S unit down on a well-calibrated receiver, the vast majority of people you normally talk to for that repeater are still going to hear you very well. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why VHF, UHF seems to be a little bit more forgiving. Let's see what Dave's got to say about all this. KC2ZQJ, you got it, Dave.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Yeah, Ed made it a list, take N2EO, we got a comment.
Okay, you're on the list. Dave first. Go ahead, Dave.
Right, KC2ZQJ. Okay, I just got an MFJ 259B analyzer. It does 160 through 6 meters. But I have a question about them in general. On the readout, it provides, of course, SWR. It provides R, which is your impedance, and X, which I understand is reactance. So when I use this, my goal is to get the SWR as low as possible, the R as close to 50 ohms as possible, and the X as close to zero as possible. Is that correct way to use it?
Yes, it is, Dave. I've got a slight disagreement in some of your vocab, the way you've used the words. Impedance really, since the majority of us, when we represent a circuit and we talk about an equivalent circuit, we usually are talking about the Thevenin equivalent circuit. Mr. Thevenin said that almost every circuit you've ever used, I could put the right resistor and the right reactor in series with each other, put them in a black box. That's black box number two, and black box number one is your real circuit. And if I tune those Thevenin equivalent components, the resistor and the reactor, might be an inductor, might be a capacitor, they're in series. If I tune them correctly in box number two, and you make all the measurements at that specific frequency, you can't tell the difference between them. So total impedance is really R plus JX. In other words, when I talk about impedance, impedance always consists of a resistive component and a reactive component. That's what the total word impedance means. The resistive component, we call it the resistive component. And the resistive component is just one of the components of impedance. So you've got the concept right. The way you use the words could be a little bit better if you were talking to your electrical engineering professor in college and you want to use his vocabulary and you want to get an A in the course. I think you see where I'm going on that one, Dave. Let's see what Rich has got to say about all this, because I know you've built a number of antenna tuners. I think you fixed a couple of antenna tuners too, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I think there's another station in there, so I heard something coming to one on the other band. All right, Dick, the antenna tuner I have here is no longer made. It's a beast. It's called an AT-10K, was made by Palstar. It uses two, Jennings vacuum variables, and a massive roller inductor made, I believe it's either number 8 or number 10 silver plated wire. I got tired of burning up a couple of antenna tuners. It's more than I need, but I got so sick of burning up two antenna tuners that I went for this one. What I wanted to mention, I'm using on the output, I have an RF amp meter by MFJ. And I wanted to suggest that. I keep the SWR meter between the tuner and the transmitter, the tuner and the amplifier. And on the output I've got, they make three models. This is an MFJ 834H. It's got 3 amps full scale, 10 amps full scale, and 30 amps full scale, in the antenna line. Yeah, Dick, and 2EO.
Yeah, the series to the antenna amp meter is a very popular technique used by AM broadcast stations for lots and lots of years. The engineer would be tuning the controls until at some particular fixed position of the transmitter, he maximized the amperes going through the antenna. At first, it doesn't sound like makes common sense. If I'm trying to maximize the power going through the antenna, power is a combination of amps and volts. In other words, assuming the antenna was a pure resistive load, because you've done a good job of tuning the AM broadcast antenna, then however many amperes flows and how many volts flows, as long as you're measuring volts in RMS and amps in RMS units, you multiply the two together, and that's the watts, and you're trying to maximize the watts. The common sense would lead you to believe, I better have an ammeter and a voltmeter, I better have some kind of a mental arithmetic or a computer that multiplies one toward the other, that's the wattage, and I maximize the wattage. Good common sense. This is one of the places where Mother Nature is very, very friendly. Let me give you let me drop and tell you a little bit more about that. It's kind of hard to believe, but even if the antenna has a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio, even if it's got, let me pick a number, 250 ohms of capacitive reactance in series with 37 ohms of resistance, a really yucky antenna. But that's your antenna. That's the impedance you see in the shack going into the feed line. And you've got nothing but a voltmeter in one case, or in the other case, you've got nothing but an ammeter. It's hard to believe that when you do all the tuning and loading of your antenna tuner, or do whatever you can at the transmitter, so that the current going into the antenna is maximum, believe it or not, you've maximized the power. Or if on another day you use nothing but a voltmeter, and you maximize the voltage going into the antenna, you have maximized the power. You don't need the product. Yes, you need the product if you want to know the exact amount of power going into the antenna. Or, if you know the exact number of amperes and you know the exact impedance of the antenna, and you're good with the complex mathematics, you can figure out what the power was. So, the friendly thing is that maximizing the voltage maximizes the forward power, even though it doesn't sound like that at first. So, that's one of the places where it's nice and friendly. Let's see, who asked the original question on this? Try to remember now. I guess that was, that was Steve. I know we've gone quite far left and right of center. And by the way, one other thing. Let me go back to Richard. I just suddenly realized something. He said he burned up a couple of antenna tuners. Let me drop. He burned up a couple of antenna tuners. That's why he went over to these, Jennings vacuum variables. What burned up in the antenna tuners, Rich? I'd like to believe the antenna, rotary inductor or the tapped, switched tap points on the inductor, if it had those, that those, if used correctly, can usually take it. And an air variable capacitor is what's usually used in an antenna tuner. You arc one of those over, you end up with some marks on it, and there's ways you can go in there with a jeweler's file and file down the bumpy spot that you created by the arcing. So it's restorable. So when you burned one of these up, what actually got burned up, Rich? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, you remember the amplifier I built up. It puts out more soup than I care to talk about. But yeah, I arced over the capacitors. Oh, I don't remember. It's a while back. I remember the watt meter board turned into a crispy critter and did it to a couple of them. So I went for this thing. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, I'm getting a little bit more of the picture. So, Steve, I would go for it, Steve. Nothing bad's going to happen, with rare exception. And on top of that, even if you did do some minor damage to the final stage of your transmitter, when you got a guy like Andy around, WA2CDL, who can fix anything, he's one of the technical mavens of this particular group, the fallback is not serious, if you know what I mean. So, I would just go for it, Steve. KC2MDP, the guy who asked the original question, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, thank you so much, Dick. Yes, you've given me a wealth of information. Yeah, this thing is basically, it's for a QRP field radio, so there's basically not going to be any more than 5 watts running through it anyway. and it's an old MFJ, and the cross needles don't work on it, so I use SWR meter anyway, so that solves that problem. Just a one quick one, Dick. Here's my theory originally, you know, and you sort of supported it. Let me run it by you, and you tell me if I'm correct or not. Let's say, you know, the antenna platoon is designed, let's say, you know, for the 80-meter band, and the antenna needs X, Y, and Z, you know, it needs a certain amount of X, a certain amount of Y, and a certain amount of Z to get a perfect match. Now, if, let's say, the 6-meter or the 2-meter antenna needed the same variables, I mean, wouldn't it be, you know, apples to apples and oranges to oranges? Back to you.
The simplest kind of an antenna tuner would be an L network, where there's a maybe variable inductor or a tapped inductor, and a variable capacitor. The next step beyond that would be a pi network, where you've got an input capacitor, a variable inductor, and an output capacitor. That could be called X, Y, and Z. I would call it tuning 1, tuning 2, and loading, the output capacitor of a pi network. Most people call it the loading capacitor. And then there's the more elaborate versions, which are a pi plus L. So when you said X, Y, and Z, you're really telling me you've got three controls. However, if every one of your antennas was exactly a 50-ohm resistor on the frequency where you use that, I still don't think that X, Y, and Z would necessarily equal each other. So the fact that X, Y, and Z equal each other on one or two bands, you're asking, does that mean they're going to equal each other on the third band? I think the answer is, in general, no. You could be lucky, but I think in general, no. In the most general case, I think X, Y, and Z are going to be different for each band and a little bit different from the high end or the low end of the band. So you have to go one step further to actually figure out what is the maximum minimum capacitor for C1, what's the maximum minimum inductance for L1, and so on. And then once you study a little bit more about how to combine, let me drop it. How to combine your load resistor, which is the output end of this network going into the antenna, your load impedance, how to combine that with these components that are inside the antenna tuner. With a modern-day computer, some of the Hewlett-Packard computers, for instance, which do a beautiful job of handling complex mathematics. That's mathematics where each individual variable really has a resistive component and a reactive component for each individual variable of an equation, so to speak. You get one of those computers, and it's easy for you to start off with the load, plug that into the computer, start off with the first capacitor to ground, which might be the output loading capacitor, put that into the computer, calculate what happens when you put the two in shunt with each other, and so on. Step by step with a modern-day computer, handheld computer, among others, and even some of the desktops with the right program, you could work out the mathematics and figure out exactly what's going on if you wanted to. But I'll warn you, it's getting a little bit deep. It's good knowledge to know, but maybe you don't want to make that particular investment at this time. But as I see it in general, you can't assume everything's going to be equal just because it was on two bands, but the third band is going to be equal. And when you're only running 5 watts, boy, you can get away with murder at the 5-watt level, Steve. You can't get yourself in trouble no matter what you do, unless it's a very delicate transmitter that can't tolerate very much reflective power, and they're kind of rare. But a 5-watt transmitter is even easier for Andy to fix. That's only going to take him 10 minutes instead of 20 minutes to fix it. Back to you for a final, Steve. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, thank you so much for the wealth of information. Yeah, that's basically the only thing I'm concerned about, and I think it's got a fold-back circuit on that anyway. So, very good. I appreciate all the information, Dick, and Rich and Mel, everyone else out there who contributed, and I'll be listening. Thanks again, guys.
I did hear a very weak station that sounded like blank ZZ Mobile 2. If that person has a comment on this subject, go ahead right now. And if he wants me to add him to the list of the first hour's worth of people, tell me he wants to be added to the list. So that person, blank blank ZZ / Mobile 2. Go right ahead right now, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
N2 HSZ Mobile 2.
Okay, your signal is very weak, but I did catch N2HZZ. Sound like Hotel Zulu Zulu Mobile 2. And you didn't say, but I'm going to add you to the list. Okay, and that's, I think he's number 3 or number 4. We're about to go to number 2. Dave, KC2ZQJ, you've just bubbled to the top of the list. You're number 2 on the runway. Go right ahead, Dave. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I see you're getting a little moving on in time, but if I can follow one more comment or question on this analyzer issue, I'll use my time that way. On the analyzer, you have R and X. Is the objective to make R 50 and X as close to zero, or should I be adding the two values together to equal something like 50?
Believe it or not, Dave, there's a yes and a no. If you're being asked what is the impedance of that antenna, what is the impedance of this network, the total impedance is R plus JX. What does the word J mean? J means that it's a factor in quadrature. So the total impedance is the resistance plus this quadrature term. That means it's either plus or minus 90 degrees. That's what the J means. And the X, whether it's a plus or a minus, tells you whether it's a clockwise or counterclockwise, the 90 degrees. So real impedance is the two. That's one way to answer the question. The other way is that you're adjusting the controls. You got it exactly right. You're forcing the R to be 50 ohms resistor, and you're forcing the X, the reactance, to be zero. So when you properly operate the controls in your antenna tuner, you force the impedance to be a pure resistance. Reactance in general, as a load for a transmitter, is unfriendly. You try to use as little of it as possible. There's exceptions to that rule, but that's the general rule. Hope that helps, Dave. And go ahead with your real question. KC2ZQJ, K2RIW. You only have to wait for the first beep, and you don't have to wait for all the others.
Okay, Dick, thank you. Okay, 24-foot vertical, 17 through 10-meter antenna. I put it up yesterday. It came with 4 counterpoise elements. Each of these elements is approximately 4 feet long. If you're looking at the face of a clock, they're oriented at 12, 3, 6 o'clock, and 9 o'clock. Because of the structure conditions on my site, I can only install these counterpoise elements at 7, 8, 10 o'clock, and 11 o'clock. So I'm missing one half of the antenna, everything between really 12 and 7 o'clock. And I'm wondering how that's just going to affect the performance of the antenna. And that's it. Thank you.
That's a nice question, Dave. So you really are covering essentially one half of the circle, so to speak. And that's going to give you a minor perturbation. If, for instance, you did the worst thing and didn't install all 4 of the radials and only installed 2 of them, you'd still get 90% of the performance. You're installing the equivalent of 3 of the radials. You're really missing the radial at 3 o'clock. You're very close to the 6 o'clock one at 7 o'clock. You're very close to the 12 o'clock one at 11 o'clock. So as far as the antenna is concerned, you've got 3 radials. You're missing the 4th. There's 4 there, but there's supposed to be one at 3 o'clock. If you did a very careful antenna pattern measurement, you flew your helicopter 1 mile away from your antenna and you made a great big circle around your house and you took signal and field strength readings, you'd find that the 3 o'clock reading would be a tiny bit lower than the 9 o'clock reading because of what you'd done with that counterpoise. Very, very minor. Don't lose any sleep over this one. It's going to work like a charm, Dave. KC2ZQJ. And by the way, if it doesn't, please come back and correct us. Let me drop one other comment I want to make. For anybody who's sufficiently objective and they listen to this gang that meets here, from time to time we try to sound like great experts and we know it all. We're a little bit of the blind leading the blind here is going on. We're all fishing around for the best answers, and there's a big consortium of people here trying to help each other is what's really going on. And we're not right all the time. We don't have 100% accuracy. We don't bat 1,000. Just to give you an example, There was a mini TechNet that took place 11 o'clock roughly for an hour or so Wednesday night. We had a mini TechNet on this repeater. John, me, and Wesley got together and we discussed all kinds of cabbages and kings, if you know what I mean. And I made some very strong statements on signals going forward and signals going reverse on a transmission line and whatever. And I suddenly realized that one of the things I said, at least, is pretty far wrong. And I'm going to have to correct myself on that one tonight. So because everything we say gets recorded, it's sort of peer-reviewed, people read it. There's 198,000 people that have checked into that TechNet, amateurradio.tv. And when they listen to the stuff and they find an error and they let us know about it, we come back and correct. So be careful what you listen to here, Dave. But you had a good question. And so if you come back and you find out it's not as we said, let us know. We can take it. KC2ZQJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Dave.
Oh, thank you. That's very reassuring. I did the 90% of the right, 75% of the right thing. I figured I would take a piece of copper wire across the roof and run the 3 o'clock missing ground poise element about the same distance, and I can do that sometime in the future. But that would pretty much clear up my question, and thank you once again. KC2ZQJ.
Comment?
Yeah, person with comment, we're going to get you in a minute. Dave, consider the fact that any of the antennas of a ground plane like structure, where people normally mount them in the middle of a backyard and all those ground plane radials are laid flat across the lawn or they're buried an inch below the lawn so that the lawnmower doesn't hit them, that's one possible installation. You can take any of these ground plane antennas and elevate the whole structure, put the whole thing on top of a roof, and it could be a metallic roof, you know, one with a copper sheet underneath. Anytime you take any of these ground plane-like antennas and suspend it at a higher altitude, even if everything's up in the air and the elements are, the ground plane radials are now 10 feet in the air parallel to the ground or even slanted in some crazy way, you get a little bit more performance with altitude. So that gives you other options. A person with the word comment, please give me your full call letters and name and then proceed with your comment on this subject. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yeah, it's Jeffrey, K2MIT. I had a similar situation a number of years ago, and what I ended up doing was attaching all of the ground wires, but just not making them radial. There's nothing that says you can't sort of make them sort of turn kind of sort of the same way as the existing radials, and I saw a marginal improvement. So I say try it, hook them up, and drape them the best that you can. It's going to be an improvement. It's better than not hooking them up at all.
Yeah, that's a good suggestion, Dave. I mean, correction, Jeff. When you recognize what the ground plane radials are trying to do, it's a poor man's equivalent of an infinite sheet of metal. A real dipole in free space is a thoroughly symmetric structure. At one instant of time, you're pumping positive current into the right-hand side of the dipole and negative current into the left-hand side. And you could put a sheet of metal right down the center of the dipole at right angles to the dipole itself, and it would have no effect of any kind. Once you realize that great big sheet of metal can go there, you can decide that, gee, I'm just going to feed the right-hand side of the dipole with reference to the sheet of metal. It's only half the dipole, and I'm going to eliminate the left-hand side. And then I'm going to take that whole structure and rotate it 90 degrees and make the sheet of metal parallel to the ground. It's a beautiful antenna, a so-called quarter-wave monopole. And then you can start making a skeleton structure for that sheet of metal. So those ground plane radials are there to act like a poor man's equivalent of a sheet of metal. It's trying to stop the current from flowing down the outside of the coax cable. Let me drop. And if this is the best of all worlds, you're trying to lay down enough ground plane radials that when it's on the top of your lawn, the RF energy, because of its wavelength, can't see the space between those radials, can't see the dirt, if you know what I mean. Any of the RF energy that managed to go between the radials and get down to the dirt is a lossy substance, a volumetric lossy substance, and you're going to be heating up your lawn and making the worms happy in the wintertime, so to speak, but that's wasted energy. So In the ideal world, you put down enough ground plane radials so that the spacing between them is such a small fraction of a wavelength that not enough energy goes through. That requirement for not enough energy hitting the Earth goes away if you take the whole darn structure and raise it in the, above the ground. The average guy who looks at, let me drop. The average guy who looks at a station master antenna for the first time, one of these antennas used for omnidirectional pancake pattern repeater-like service, where you've got three little ground plane radials at the bottom of this great big vertical stacked fiberglass radome thing. You have these three little radios down, to, down at the bottom at 120-degree azimuth angles, and they're all slanted down at a 30-degree. The average person looks at that and says, how in the world can such a poor ground plane radial system be high in efficiency, whereas if I wanted 98% efficiency with a ground plane HF antenna in the backyard, I'd have to lay down 32 radials. How can they get away with three? And the answer is, it's up in the air. It can't see the dirt. And those three radials are enough to stop 98%, so to speak, of the current from flowing down the outside of the coax cable, and they do the job. So, as you can see, there's funny ways of looking at it, but it gives you a little bit more of understanding of where the physics involved is. You're trying to, you don't want the RF to see the dirt, but if everything's elevated, you can get away with murder. Two ground plane radials are going to give you 90% of the performance, if you know what I mean. Let's see now. I think the third person...
coming.
Go ahead, Wes.
I recall that conversation, and the question was, how many radars should I put? They say, there is no specific number of radios that you have put. In some situation, you can go with one radio only. With some, two is not enough. And two XGF.
If it's an antenna high enough in the air, so that it doesn't see the Earth, one radio is enough. And that one radio, you make it collinear, and the antenna is called dipole. And if you really want it to be a ground plane, then you put more of those radials, but two or three of them is more than enough up in the air. Down on the ground, it's a law of diminishing returns. You always get a little bit more performance as you add more and more radials, and there have been a number of articles who have, of guys who have added 32 radials on the ground. And although it's an asymptotic curve of improvement, in other words, it's starting to flatten out, you're approaching the law of diminishing returns, you're still getting a little bit of improvement when you go from 30 radials to 32 radials on the ground. Up in the air, the answer is no. One is enough up in the air. If you've got enough altitude to make that one radio collinear and you call it dipole, it's a beautiful thing. One of the antennas that have been very poorly used in the past, for guys who have got a tall enough tree or a tall enough tower, let me drop. A pure vertical dipole is an extremely high performance antenna. If you've got enough, now very few of us have got 140 feet of tower where we can put up a 132 foot long vertical dipole on 80 meters. But if you could, guarantee you would love the performance you can get out of it. And you don't necessarily have to feed it in the middle. If you're smart enough, that full half wave vertical dipole on 80 meters, 132 foot length of one single piece of wire with no center insulator, you can feed it at the bottom as long as you can impedance step up to roughly 1500 ohms, and you do that, it's a very conveniently fed antenna of extremely high performance. Everybody looks at all of the manuals that we go through where we study for our amateur radio exam, and every dipole we have ever seen is completely flat, parallel to the ground, fed in the center, and each side of the dipole is completely straight and there's no curves to it, no zigzags and whatever. And we're all led to believe if you don't build a dipole that way, it's going to explode. Far from the truth. You'd be amazed how much you can get away with if you know what you're doing, if you're smart enough.
I have a question, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
You have a 40 meters high tower. You have a wire that is going in parallel to that tower. This is your halfway for 80 meters antenna. Now, the tower by itself is grounded. It is your counterpoise, or it's a twin lead antenna. What do you think about it?
talking about a vertical dipole, and by the way, the word vertical dipole is a relative set of words. For simplistic reasons, you might operate it as a sloping antenna, 20, 30, 40 degrees.